you are being prepped for something bigger. I truly believe that.
Yeah.
I truly believe you are being prepped for what you are doing today, because you are kind of fighting a massive beast right now. And I want to ask you,
why do all the other girls who had my same training regimen not do anything?
Exactly.
That's the question.
No, but I mean, I truly believe, in all honesty, Jen, like, you have a special purpose. Like, I'm just, that's where I come from. Like, you have a special, you were meant to do this. Where did that strength come from at 8 years old, where you were practicing for 30 hours?
Yeah, I started gymnastics when I was like six, which is kind of normal. In fact, now they kind of start earlier, but I started in about 1974, just 2 years after Title IX passed, which is particularly relevant, I think. And I was just like a energetic kid, pretty athletic. I was doing other sports, I did dance, but I really just fell in love with gymnastics. So in the beginning, it wasn't like it required any sort of crazy work ethic. I just want to do it all the time because I loved it. Like, think about how fun gymnastics is before you like break your first bone. You're flipping around and I mean, it's just amazingly fun. You're defying gravity. And, you know, in my first book, Jocked Up, that's how I end it. Despite all of the everything, the travails that I went through, I miss that feeling every day of just flying. Like, it's amazing.
Yeah.
So I don't think it really required a work ethic per se. I was a kid having fun.
Okay.
You know, and then I started winning, and that's super fun.
Yeah.
And when it really got hard is when I moved gyms when I was about 14, because I just really, I was on the national team, but I wanted to get in the top six. Like, that's, the top six is like, that's the thing.
Yeah.
That's when you get to go to Worlds and you go to the Olympics and all of that. And so I begged my parents to go to one of the best gyms in the country, and they said yes, and I moved away from home. And that's when the practices got insane. I mean, they were longer, but it's not even about the length. I mean, yes, I was training about 7-8 hours a day, 10 in the summer, but it was really intense. And I would say that's when it got very abusive as well. And that's when all of the focus on weight and the, you know, multiple weigh-ins a day and being humiliated on the loudspeaker if you gain a quarter pound, that's when all that started. And the crazy part is that is when I sort of leapt forward. You know, my first competition, I think with that team, I placed sixth at nationals, which was like a huge leap forward. But I kept breaking bones. I mean, I wasn't eating anything. That can't be good for your bone strength. And I ended up breaking my femur at my World Championships in 1985. And I came back too fast. You know, I won nationals. I won the USA Championships in less than a year, 9 months later, after this horrific injury on the world stage. But like, I just kept going. But it's interesting, the night that I won USA's, I was like, I should stop now.
Really?
Like, I just knew it in my head, you know. I knew it. I was like, this is as good as it gets. I'm in so much pain. I won on a broken ankle.
That's incredible.
It was a horrible night in some ways, because all of the athletes and coaches were saying I didn't deserve it. You know, I'm this 16-year-old kid. And so it was just like this brutal moment, even though it was the biggest accomplishment of my life. And I, of course, did decide to keep going, because you're in for a dime, you're in for a dollar, you know, you put your whole life into this. And the next year and a half was really destructive for me emotionally and physically. And I did end up walking away, but I don't know. It's like, I'm still like this. Like, I, some people do it. It's like, work for me is pretty joyful. It's hard, but I derive a great sense of accomplishment when I do something really hard and I want to keep doing it. And if you tell me I can't do something, that makes me want to do it more. And I don't think you can teach that.
Yeah.
I think that's just in some people.
Yeah.
Well, that's amazing.
Would you say you're someone that takes those scars and you run with it, and you're like, you accept those scars, and would you say that you would do it all over again, considering everything that you've been through?
I would say that describes me now.
Yeah.
And I certainly keep getting knocked down and keep getting up. At the time, at 19, when I walked away from the sport, and I was so broken, I mean, just completely emotionally frayed. And I mean, I didn't really want to live. I contemplated killing myself all the time.
Okay.
I was going off to college and I was on crutches because I had had my first surgery for my ankle, and I felt like I was going to a retirement home. You know, you go to college and all the other kids are like, and I was like, please let me rest. I just want to rest. I've been training. And so it took me a very long time to get past that. And I was very angry about the experience in gymnastics and the abuse I dealt with. And then I got to a place that was, I'm grateful for that experience. I'm proud of what I achieved. I don't want another child to ever have to go through that. And that's when I really started to fight. And I wrote my first book. And now I do what you described, which is I take those barriers. I take getting knocked down as sort of a badge of honor because I keep getting back up. But when you're 20, you have to learn that lesson.
You're
just forming.
Yeah.
Well, I have a question too. Let's go back to you being a child athlete. I mean, we have an 8-year-old boy, and that's why I say, like, he's done shooting hoops. I'm tired, mom. And so I listened to your story where you were, I want to practice for 30 hours. And we're like, Cyrus, come watch this. Like, she's amazing.
Funny.
It's hilarious. But would you say that, parents today are too hard? I mean, do you think there's something to that where we're seeing a culture here where the pressure for young kids, I mean, we're saying kindergarten, we're seeing, 8, 9-year-olds where we have one child and we're like, we're learning as we go, holy cow. Would you say that's an issue?
Yeah. I think it is. I mean, I have 4.
Okay.
And so I have pretty well-formed opinions about, parenting and how each child does sort of need to be parented differently. You don't parent every child the same way because they all have their different strengths and weaknesses. Mm-hmm. I think, back when I was doing gymnastics, the parents were nuts. They probably still are. I mean, it was just like typical stage parents, really bad. And my parents were much saner and sort of kept the whole thing in perspective. But, I'll say this, and we struggled for a long time. When I told them I wanted to leave the sport, they completely freaked out. And we had years of very troubled relationships. And they regret that now. Because, of course, now they see you support your child and you tell them they have value, even if they're not doing that sport anymore. And we love you. And we know that you're suffering and we want to help you make the transition. But in their minds, it was like they had given up so much and they couldn't let go of it. They got indoctrinated in the mindset of these other parents to some extent. I think in fairness to them, they were worried I would regret it. I was this young person. It was just another year. But one more year on 300 calories a day, 10 hours a day on a broken ankle, one more year is not really possible. So I see it. I have a 10 and an 8-year-old, and my 10-year-old is very serious about soccer. And I can't sit with the parents on the sidelines. What I see, which is, I wonder if this is, similar to your observation, they're sort of aware that they shouldn't be like the insane parents from the 80s, So they pretend to be more measured.
Yeah.
But they're not. No. It's like they're sitting there and they all think their kid's going to the Olympics. And they all, it's like, do you know the odds of that? It's like close to zero.
Yeah.
I don't care how good your kid is at 10. And it takes this remarkable combination of extreme talent, the exact right body type for a sport, willingness to work harder than anyone can imagine. Like, look at someone like Michael Phelps. Yeah. Yes, he is incredibly talented and gifted, and he has this body type that was just built for swimming, but I guarantee you he worked harder than anyone else also.
Of course.
And that combination is so rare. And so I think as parents, your job is to help clear the way for them to find the thing they love the most. And that may not be sports.
Yeah.
Yeah.
100%. But do you feel like what you went through, and so this is the main question I really, because you're there's a lot you from Larry Nassar. I mean, I reacted to that as it was happening in real time when I learned about it. I actually posted about it, like almost crying, because I couldn't believe,
it's
not
brutal.
Necessarily what he had done, but that it was covered up by adults, that these women, these young girls were not protected. And then I read about you, and you were almost the lone person who first said, this is not okay. See, I still get very angry
and
about
it. I think I heard you say there was over 500 cases of sexual abuse as well.
Yeah. So I had written my book in 2008 called Chalked Up, which is about the culture of abuse. Had nothing to do with Nassar. Believe me, there's abusers way beyond Nassar. Yes. My coaches were extremely physically and emotionally abusive. 20% of the coaches on staff were known pedophiles. And, you know, we were just supposed to ignore that fact and kind of avoid them. The national team coach that I traveled around the world with is now banned from the sport. He raped a close friend of mine multiple times. I managed to avoid these men pretty successfully. But as a child, when you know that you're being put in their care and the adults around you are like, don't talk about it. Just avoid him. Like, I'm not going to argue I was not sexually abused. I'm not going to argue that what I went through was the same, as what they went through. But you do feel like you don't matter when they're saying, well, okay, maybe he did those things, but he's a great man and he's a great coach, so let's just not say anything, which is what everybody said. So, you know, in 2008, I was the only one talking about it, and it didn't go particularly well for me. It was sort of my first cancellation. And so journalists were investigating the case of Nassar. They were calling me. Because I was the only one, you know, do you know anyone? Do you know that anyone has happened? So I was aware before the news hit the papers. And over time, I worked pretty closely with the civil attorney. And so I got to know a lot of the young women, and they're amazing. And yes, there are over 500 victims because it was over 30 years. Most of them gymnastics, but not all. And the other crazy part is there were multiple reports to multiple governing bodies and police, because, you know, he also abused at Michigan State University. And so it was reported to the police, the campus police, every time he went in and defended himself. And they were like, okay, that's fine. I mean, it's just so bonkers. And I agree with you, the most, besides what he did, which is obviously disgusting, the thing that's most upsetting, and I know every in and out of this case, is how the evidence was destroyed and swept under the rug by USA Gymnastics and the US Olympic Committee. They did it repeatedly. And so interesting, because in my head, when I came out, you know, with my story, and the pushback was so intense, and I was like, everybody knows this. Everybody knows the Strausses are physically and emotionally abused. They do it on the competition floor. Like, it's still known for it. Why are my own teammates, why is USAG denying this? Why don't they investigate? Part of it is that behavior is normalized, so they don't think it's abuse. But I was like, there's something even worse happening. I don't know what it is. But there's something else going on.
What was your, at this stage, what is your conclusion to why it was swept under the rug? What, within the gymnastics world and with the federal, with our government?
Like,
why do
with
you
the FBI.
Think, I mean, I can tell you, I was irate. So what is your conclusion at this point of why they would even do it? Maybe gymnastics, I can understand they don't want to harm the brand, but with our own government, why?
Yeah, that's a great question. Weak, cowardly adults who don't give a darn about kids is the main thing. You know, you had gym owners who didn't want to tarnish, you know, these aren't wealthy people who run gyms. They don't want to tarnish the reputation of the sport, because that will impact how many girls come in to take lessons. They make money off the kids that take lessons, not the team girls. But having a team with kids on the national team is like great marketing. Well, you know what's not great marketing is saying that the entire sport is rife with pedophiles. But rather than try to clean that up, you know, they covered it up and they tried to further this image of these shiny, happy little pixies bouncing around, because what parent is that, you know? And I think also, because this goes back to the 70s, at least in my experience, right? I think there was a different idea of what was acceptable. Like, I do really think in this weird world, it got normalized and it wasn't seen as abuse. It was seen as tough coaching. You know, so that's part of it. I mean, at least the physical and emotional abuse, which I believe set the stage for the sexual abuse. And then I think as far as the FBI goes, and just so your listeners understand what you're referring to there, once a USA team member, her name is Maggie Nichols, reported this, and there were others, there was Allie Raisman, as well as Simone Biles. This was reported to the FBI. The FBI did nothing for over a year.
Yep.
To investigate. And here's what I will tell you. The head of USA Gymnastics, a man named Steve Penny, who was invested in maintaining the reputation of the sport, especially leading up to the Olympics, which is when they make all their money with sponsors, he found a weak-willed, pathetic FBI agent in Indianapolis, and he made promises to him. You know, he said, I'll help you get a job in security with the Olympic Committee. I'll help you. Just, you know, slow roll this. They wanted it to be after the Olympics. I think he sort of knew it would come out. Yeah. But keep in mind, this man, Steve Penny, had destroyed evidence. He had covered up for years. So he knew if this came out, that he was in big in big trouble. He has not seen the trouble that I wish that he would at this point. But I think that's why. He just, you know, everybody was motivated by self, by the self and by what would advantage them and money to some extent. And they just didn't care about the kids at all. And a lot of the adults in the sport don't. Many do. I had this amazing coach between the ages of 10 and 13, who's, she's no longer with us, but just the most amazing woman ever. And she recognized that sports are really just about character development for young people.
Yeah.
That's really the purpose. Like, who cares if I can do a cartwheel? I'm 56. No one gives a shit. Sorry. It's like the whole point is to develop strength of character, discipline, perseverance. Yes. And she really knew that. And that's how she trained us.
Yeah. Under this, not to get political, but this new administration with Kash Patel, do you think there will be any updates to any of the cases in the past? I assume not everyone has been held responsible for their the damages that they've done to these people. Do you think there's something?
Well, the FBI, just less than a year ago, the FBI made a close to $100 million payment to the athletes. Okay. I don't know how they allocated it across the athletes who were abused. I'm sure it's most linked, you know, not to all 500, but to those who actually reported to the FBI and those who were abused from that report on, because arguably that would have been prevented. So, you know, those abused between 2015 and late 2016, I imagine, you know, I don't know the ins and outs of it, but with that payment, there was an agreement that,
it was done.
You know, that was it. Yeah. That was the end of it. So I would not expect any more here. I would hope that given everything that has happened, coaches would adopt a new mindset and a new approach. I think culture change is hard. These people have been coaching this way for a very long time. And so I'm not fully confident that things have changed. I will tell you this, as part of the Nassar scandal, we'll call it, something was established called the Safe Sport Act. Okay. So that's legislation.
Yes.
And I was there for the first meeting with Senator Dianne Feinstein. And you know, I will say this about her. This was, you know, I think she was pretty, you know, solid then, or she seemed so in the meeting. And she said, I promise you, I will get this done. She said to us, the 10 of us in the room. And it was really quite moving. I mean, I was there with my daughter who was like 4 months old at the time. They asked me to be there. I was like, I'm coming. Like, I'm not missing this. Yeah. You know, I had the Bjorn and the whole, the whole thing. But so part of what this legislation did was it made it a crime to know about abuse and not report it. So it basically made all coaches mandatory reporters, like they weren't before. So my head coaches could know that coaches on their staff were abusing, but they didn't have to do anything. Like a teacher and a social worker have to, but they didn't. So it made them mandatory reporters. Good. It also established an organization called the Center for Safe Sports. So there's a process and a protocol now for reporting this stuff. Like I had no one to tell.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't know what to do.
Yeah.
That U.S. Center for Safe Sport, it has a 4-year lag time right now because of how many cases are being reported.
Wow.
That's so sad. I mean, that's sad, but I'm glad that's implemented.
Yeah.
I didn't know that. That's huge.
Yeah.
It says it's not better, though, right? It says the culture hasn't really changed.
And no.
Last I understood, they don't even accept reports of physical and emotional abuse because they're so far behind on the sexual abuse cases.
This I assume it forged you as who you are right now. And it's like, we saw your Substack this morning And you talk about, am I doing feminism? I think you, I don't, you know, I'm paraphrasing, but I, am I doing feminism correctly? I think you said.
Because that's just now just, well, what I said does that mean these days?
It's like. Yeah. Like, what's the difference between what you're doing and what feminism is, I guess would be the question.
Because a normal person, I would think you are a feminist. You are somebody who is truly sticking up for women. You would think that's what it, you know, going back to, you know, 60s and 70s. And yeah, it's like in 2025 now, but it's not, I guess. you're not a I don't know, but.
Yeah.
I don't know. That was sort of the question I raised in the piece is like, what is it anymore? And a lot of women have never wanted to be associated with the term for a very, you know, for various reasons, women on the right and women on the left. The first wave was really all about voting rights, you know, and the suffragettes. And the second wave was about more equality in the workplace. And also, you know, the second wave established women's private spaces. And really Title IX as well, so equality of opportunity. But you know, up until the early 70s, women could not get a credit card without their husband's approval. In some states, they couldn't own property. You couldn't leave your husband even if he was beating you. There were no battered women's shelters or safe spaces. So, you know, I feel like, and I came of age and went to college in the 80s and learned about these women, and I was like, I'm in on that. You know, like, who doesn't think women should vote and get paid equally for equal work and have a safe place to go when they're in danger? Like, who doesn't agree with that? It seems bonkers to not agree with that. And then it started to get kooky a little bit, because I don't know what wave we're in at this point, but in the like girls gone wild phase, I don't know. I would say the third wave, which started when I was in college, but kind of went well beyond that into the 90s, it was this like sexual freedom. It was like, the revolution. I can sleep with whoever I want. And that's feminism. And I'm not sure that has served women very well at all. And now we're in this insane fourth wave where it's like, we need to celebrate men who say they're women and let them take our opportunities. And that's where I'm like, okay, I was already questioning that third wave of like, you go, girl, show us your, you know, that wasn't my jam. But I just go back to this. I'm not letting them take this word from me.
No.
I believe in the basics. And, you know, I will tell you, and I wrote about it in the piece. I spoke last year at Turning Point's Young Women's Conference. And is, you know, 2,000 very young women. We come from very different places. You know, they're mostly Christian, although there were some religious Jews. I'm Jewish, but not very religious. I'm not a religious person. I'm a feminist. I come from the left, though I'm not anymore. And I had written a speech about why I still consider myself a feminist. And I thought about taking it out when I got there, because the tagline for the conference was feminine, not feminist. And I was like, I'm not going to take it out. They invited me to hear a different perspective. Really what I talked about was standing up to injustice, but and wherever you find that strength to do so, whether it's your faith or your own kind of internal moral clarity, or it, I don't care where you get it from, but I decided to leave my opener about being a feminist despite the t-shirts I was wearing, and they all cheered, because no one disagrees that women should get paid the same for equal work or have the right to vote or own property. Who disagrees with that? No one.
Nobody. It's insane.
So I'm still a feminist.
Yes, as you should be. I mean, that's, I mean, that's kind of where, I mean, you were going to ask her, like, we did reading that you don't come from a place of, you know, you're not who's religious or overly religious or anything like that. I mean, we are, I mean, we're Catholic and we get our strength a lot from our faith, but you have such, you know, you think of David and Goliath sometimes, and we look at you and what you are up against, it's just incredible what you've taken on. Did you know, and I think you've answered this before, but did you know what was to ensue when you said, all right, I'm going all in. I'm gonna be this person who cannot sit back and just stay quiet. I mean, the slogan for our show is never conform to be liked. And it's just kind of like,
That's a good one.
I'm not going to sit here and appease all these people for you to like me. I come from the entertainment world. I come from the modeling and acting world in New York City. Yeah. I had an eating disorder and I was surrounded by so many people who were just kind of like, oh, you better fall in line, Sarah, you know, wink, wink, smile and wave. You want to work, right? You want this successful career still, right?
Yep.
Where did you, when did you say, I mean, this is where I'm just get animated. I'm like, what in your brain clicked and you were like, all right, I'm doing it. I'm going all in.
Putting yourself out there like that.
Because you're jumping into fire.
When did you experience that in entertainment? Like, what were the years? Was it in the 90s or the 2000s?
No, so I was on the show America's Next Top Model in 2004. And then I moved to New York. And so from 2004 till 2020, basically, or 2019, I was a full-time model actress. I was with Ford Models, Elite Models, Innovative Artists. I mean, I've worked on film, TV. L'Oreal. Wow. I mean, I would say not to brag, I was just a successful working model in New York. Yeah. A working model. I wasn't a super, but I was a working model.
Yeah.
I mean, the show top
That's
model.
That's successful.
Thank you. Yeah. And that kind of brought that 15 minutes of TV fame that was hilarious, but I worked my butt off. It didn't give me anything.
Yeah.
I worked my butt off and I stuck to it, but it came with a lot of darkness. And that's kind of where this show was created. Cause I was a city girl living in a very dark world. Yeah. And I kind of came to light and saying, all right, I'm making a lot of money. I'm booking all these amazing jobs and commercials and stuff, but I am miserable. There's something missing in my life.
Yeah.
For me, it was my faith again, going back to that. Cause I became very self, it's a very self-centered world that I lived in. And I was an athlete too. I've had 3 knee operations and, you know, ACL, meniscus tear, volleyball, basketball. That's where I connect with you. Because as an athlete, I lived and breathed sports. Like if I, I was going to go play, like this is my life. And then my husband and I play against each other outside of our house, our basketball hoop. And I think of you, Jen, I'm so creepy. No, but I'm like, oh my gosh, babe, if you played against me and you were doing like, what would that look like?
Yeah,
it's just insane.
Men playing, it's insane. And women getting actually hurt too because of these guys, and it's sickening. I can't believe we even have to have this conversation.
That's what we say. Like, I graduated in 99 of high school. So I played varsity my sophomore year to my senior year. And we would have been laughing at people if they had ever mentioned this, I feel like, left or right.
Yeah.
I mean, I grew up in South Seattle.
Yeah.
I mean, it is 99.9% liberal Democrats.
Yeah. Blue.
Blue. Very urban, very. And I would tell you, every single person I know would have been laughing. Not today.
Yeah.
What happened?
No, not today. Well, if I go back to your first question at the start about where do I get it?
Yes.
I think it's my, now I'm old enough and I know better. I'm, you know, older than you guys. I'm in my mid 50s and now I know when I say something that the response is going to be. But, you know, when I sat down to write my first book, I was almost 40 and I really had no idea that the back, because I just thought everybody knew. It was like a secret, but it was an open secret. And so I thought once I really wrote it so that I could heal myself.
Yeah.
You know, to make sense of it and understand. And I was utterly ill-prepared for the backlash.
Really?
From my own teammates who called me the worst names you can imagine. And so, but, you know, as that came, I retreated a bit at first. It was also very early days of social media. So I didn't understand that dynamic in 2008, the way you will get trolled and dragged and, you know, I didn't know not to look at it, which I don't really do now.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to argue my case and prove that I was speaking from a place of honesty and that I was really trying to protect young girls. And that was, you can't really do that. So I retreated at first, but then the more they came after me, the more determined I got. So then I was like, no one else is going to do this. So I have to do it.
Yeah.
And I got bolder and more, I think, definitive, because at first I would sort of try to couch it. I would say things like, well, I'm not, this is not an indictment of the sport. This was just my experience.
Yeah.
No, it was the whole sport was rotten to the core. And so I got stronger as I went. I was redeemed in 2018 when Larry Nassar went to prison and there were all these people a new generation who didn't know me from the past, new generation of gymnasts and gymnast fans who were like, she's a hero.
Yeah.
And even some of the old ones pretended they'd always supported me. They didn't, I remember. And so then it was like, it all worked out for me. I mean, it didn't work out in that,
yeah,
obviously hundreds of children were harmed, but
yeah,
it was like sticking with the truth and staying strong and enduring the slings and arrows. It was okay in the end, you know? And that didn't last long, because then in 2020, right in March 2020, I said absolutely not to any of the restrictions on kids, public school closures in particular.
Gonna talk about
but
that.
Again, yeah. I was really naive. Yeah, I mean, again, I was super naive. I thought, well, everyone's going to see this is wrong.
It makes sense, like, to a rational person.
Everyone's going to see it. Yeah. And I just had this experience with gymnastics. And I was like, they'll see if I'm nice and diplomatic and I cite the data and I'm a public school mom and yeah, I know the population in the public schools. They'll see.
Yeah.
And I didn't have a lot of followers. So I thought, like, am I just like shouting into the wind? Like, I don't even know.
Yeah.
And I was not, because about 6 months in, I started getting a real dragging on the internet. And it was only at that point that I had to make an active decision to keep going.
Yeah.
Because I had a lot, I really had a lot to lose.
Yeah.
I had my whole life that I had worked for, my professional status, my career in court and standing in corporate America, mm-hmm, my friends. I mean, I've lost pretty much everything, but I made an active decision, yeah, that I would keep going because it mattered.
Yeah.
And so that was so difficult. And after 2 years, I ended up resigning from my job.
I was gonna say, yeah.
And we moved to Colorado, and you know, I eventually had this idea for this brand, which we'll talk about. That, yeah, I knew going in. That, yeah, I was like, okay, you can't cancel me a third time.
Yeah.
Let's just do this. But I think I'm just naive, sort of. I was the first two times,
well,
you know? Wow. But that's a gift. That was a gift.
100%.
It is. And you, like, people like me, I mean, I was going to say this because we are going to talk about your line, which I love. Absolutely. And I love, and I want to talk about going up against the beast of Nike and Adidas, all these other companies and what you go through. But I just, as a former athlete, like, again, I go back to me as a, you know, 15, 16 year old and just say, what would I have done? What would I have done if this was put, well, I know my mother would never have allowed it, yeah, but what would I have done? And you talk about that too,
mm-hmm,
like as an athlete.
Well, with the men.
Well,
sports.
Yeah. You say a lot about that.
Yeah. I mean, it's pretty disgusting, but I also wanted to talk about, cause you talk about the COVID stuff. And we were talking about this before the show. It's, yeah, like, when did you know that all this COVID stuff was just like, because we had to shut up. We had a business at the time. We had our own gym and we had to shut down for 6 months.
Because you fought many beasts. I mean, there's markers on the timeline here where you're just kind of like taking.
When did you see that? Yeah. It was like, this is BS. Like, what's happening right now?
Yeah.
Well, I'll give full credit to my husband. I mean, we were never afraid of COVID. Yeah. And from the very outset, even before lockdowns happened, we were reading about, you know, what was going on in Italy. If you recall, there were all, you know, in February, the news reports, you know, dead people in the streets. And we were reading and trying to find, you know, data.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll never forget that from the beginning, they said the median age of death was 82.
Oh.
And I thought,
yeah,
okay, well, those are old and very frail people,
yeah, mm-hmm,
who were some, I mean, I don't mean to sound mean, but like, yeah, we do all die.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And something does, you know, old people often die of pneumonia or a cold. You know, they used to call pneumonia the old man's best friend because it was sort of a gentle way,
mm-hmm,
way out. So we were never afraid. My husband was very angry. I was panicking and trying to work while we were shut down. I would say we knew, you know, led by him, but I was right there from the beginning. And I was very focused on schools. I had been a public school mom since my older children had first started school. They started school in 2005, my oldest. This is my second husband. So he didn't have children that had been in the public school system. I had already graduated one and had another about to graduate. You know, these kids were my kids' friends. I knew how vulnerable this population was. it doesn't take a genius to figure it out. Let me be clear. You know, 60% of the kids in San Francisco public schools are on free and reduced lunch. That means they're living, you know, at or below the poverty line in many instances. They're not getting food. Abuse is not being detected. They have no adult to, you know, say something nice to them during the day just to kind of lift them up. And it just was heartbreaking to me. And I very much focused on schools. You know, he was raging against all of it. Yeah. I thought, as sort of a, I thought kids could be the bridge to get people to understand, and that if I spoke calmly and diplomatically about the schools, they would listen.
Yeah.
That did not happen. But there was not a day that we were afraid. And here's the one other thing I will just add. What I firmly believe is, I don't care how actually dangerous it is. You can't shut down the world. You can't. I don't care if COVID was 10 times more lethal. You can't. It's an egregious violation of our civil liberties. If it's that dangerous, people will stay home.
Yeah.
You can't do it, because if you say there's a bar, if you say like, okay, if this is the infection fatality rate, that will be manufactured.
Yeah.
So. Right. Yeah. And so it can never happen. So I don't care if bird flu. I don't believe anything.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. But this is a free country. The government cannot, without legislating, just shut the world down.
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to try to find. I printed out the New York Times article that just came out. I'm going to see my clipboard here. That just kind of, you know, said, oh, we were wrong. We should not have shut down schools, especially kids in poor neighborhoods, which we, you know, it just, they were already behind academically. And here you are shutting them down, some of them for over a year. And I tell you again, Jen, when something that gets us irate, when our blood, we like, okay, forgive, we're about forgiveness. But when you talk about COVID what happened to, I mean, not to make it about us, what, we're just one family, one business. We owned a gym.
Yeah.
And what was said to us, what was threatened against us.
Yeah.
When we were trying to make a living, when they said we had a small kind of elite private training gym where we just had clients in some small classes. And then they were like, shut it down or else. But by the way, husband, by the way, Sarah, you can go work for Amazon for $16 an hour where there's hundreds of people.
Right.
You know, you can go work and do these. You can go work at that liquor store down the street. You can go work at Walmart, Pierre.
Yeah. Like,
but shut your gym down.
A weed dispensary.
Yeah, it's weed dispensaries. Yeah.
We were like, okay, so no, this doesn't add up. When we saw politicians, I'm going to calm down. When we saw politicians going out to eat without their masks on, we just, like you said, even before all that, we did the math. And 1 + 1 did not equal 5.
Yeah.
1 + 1 equaled 2.
Yeah.
And they were trying to convince us it equaled 5. And if you didn't say it equaled 5, you were a grandma killer.
Yeah.
I think I was a grandma killer like 100 times.
Yeah, I definitely heard that one.
You know,
yeah, me too. And a racist.
Oh, yeah.
I was like, we were the dumbest thing. The argument that you, because I was like, can you please clarify why I'm a racist? Because I want public schools open. It's the black and brown children that are being kept out of school. Because guess what? The rich white kids are in school because the private schools
are open. Yeah.
Their argument was, you don't care if black children die.
Yeah.
Wow.
That's why you're racist.
What's a lazy response?
And my argument back was, you know, to use their language, is that, you know, closed public schools, it was the most structurally racist policy since Jim Crow.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it really was, because the kids shuttered from school were black. They were Latino. They were poorer on average, or else they would have been in the privates. It really harmed the vulnerable children and homeless children. I mean, 5% of San Francisco public school students are actually homeless.
Gosh.
Wow.
What, the only warm place they can go and get food in a day was in school.
Yeah.
That's insane.
Not to imagine the abuse. Imagine the abuse that's being done at home and they don't have an outlet.
Yeah.
And all of this, of course, has come out. There was just a headline in the BBC 2 days ago saying, you know, poor and vulnerable children were left behind. Yeah, no.
Shocker.
But, you know, it didn't stop that. You know, it wasn't just that they had to further these policies. They had to vilify and demonize anyone who said anything that contradicted them. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, someone like me who was, you know, not just respectable and a lefty who they want to comfort the most, you know, mm-hmm. The left eats their own because they want to make an example of you. I was also a leader in San Francisco and my community. I was just like red meat. I mean, people posted my address online.
That's insane.
What possible reason could anyone have to post my address? There were, you know, people posting. This took about a year, but, you know, business partners that I had while at Levi's, you know, the goal being obviously to have those partners complain about me. It just went on and on. I was chased down the street by people screaming at me. They wouldn't care if my children died. We eventually left, you know, left San Francisco. This is the kind and tolerant left, mind you, of course.
Yeah.
So I have no forgiveness, and I know people are like, you can't hold on to anger. Look, I keep it in a little
compartment.
I live a very happy and joyful life. Yes. I love my children. I love my husband. We have fun. But I'm not, I don't know, maybe that's maybe I need some faith, but I'm keeping it. It's right here and it fuels me and it's contained. It doesn't infect my entire existence, but I deserve to be angry on behalf of all the children that were harmed and on behalf of myself. I get to be mad. Those people, it's unconscionable. And all of the people that were wrong, there's been no punishment.
None
at all.
Or even an apology. I mean, I say so much of those people, they will cut their nose off to spite their face. Like, they will never concede or say they were wrong about anything, even if it's right in front of them.
You're working, I know your field to make these movies and write these books, and you were working on Generation COVID with Andrew James, is that correct?
Yeah, we're still working on it. We have, you know, tight budget, but I just reviewed a final cut last night. Yay. We decided after I resigned from Levi's, I was like, I want to make a movie. I want to record what happened. It's going to get memory hold. And so I want to tell the story of these kids. So we filmed for about 2 years, different kids from across the country and, you know, all the different kinds of terrible kids. Kids and families faced. I mean, some the worst. We do have a family in it who lost a child to suicide. Mm. And so we've been, you know, editing the 100 or so hours of footage for the last, well, Andrew has, because he's an editor and I have story in my mind, but no editing skills. So we're very close to done. And, I had hoped to be done sooner, but I actually think the timing is good because I think people are more open.
Yeah.
To this message now. But I agree with you, there's been no apology. And in fact, one of the things that I find quite enraging is some of the most prominent and platformed COVID alarmists, I would call them, are sort of trying to pretend they were reasonable and on what I would call team reality. They're pretending now that they always wanted schools open, that they never believed in mandates. Like, it's on film.
It's all there. That's what's so funny. Just like they said, oh, COVID, the shot was going to stop COVID from spreading and you dying from it. All on tape. I mean, and then it's like, oh, we can change reality. No, what we said was it's gonna lessen the blow of COVID. No, that's not what you said. You said we were gonna die. No. We were the winter of death, and we were gonna somehow kill all of you. And that, but if you get the shot, you're free and clear of any and everything. And nothing made sense. But as I go back to that, we're going to get to your line. I mean, we'll, for a couple more minutes, but you know, my husband's a firefighter in Arizona here. And so what you're saying with these kids is the calls that a lot of these men and women go on are to young kids who did go through these lockdowns and this isolation period.
Oh, interesting.
And the suicide and mental health issue with the, I mean, not throw in social media too. I think social media has a lot to do with it. But if that's all you're looking at all day, and you're in some of these schools,
that's
locked down for a year, but you see it and, you know, you talk to other people. So, I mean, again, that is something that's parallel to, you know, if you talk to first responders, what are they seeing? What calls are they going on? Because
that's
a big one. These kids are not mentally okay, a lot of them.
Yeah. That.
Yeah, there's an ER doctor in our film, yeah. Dr. Jeannie Noble, who is an ER doctor at UCSF in San Francisco. And, you know, she's a very left-leaning, yeah. Almost a hippie. And, you know, she said in San Francisco from May 2020,
yeah.
She's like, we aren't seeing any COVID in the hospital. All we're seeing is teens who've tried to kill themselves by May. You cannot treat kids like prisoners and expect them to be okay. Yeah. You cannot lock them in their house with the only way to socialize being a screen and expect them to be okay. And they are not okay. And I really get mad at parents who are like, my kid's fine.
Yeah.
So what?
Yeah.
So what?
Yeah.
Too many are not.
Too many are not.
Too high of a percentage are not okay and never will be. Yeah. And I think we have a responsibility to all children. Yeah. I mean, people ask me all the time, why was this the hill you were willing to die on? And I look at them and I say, if you aren't willing to die on a hill for children and free speech, I don't think you even have one.
No. Yeah.
Most people don't. They would rather stand with the crowd than stand up and endure any criticism. They just want to be in with the crowd. And if they get to be with the crowd and feel super virtuous and like righteous and superior, I mean, even better, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's like they just want the applause. Again, like I said, it's smile and wave. Shut up. Sarah, do you still want to hang out with the famous? It's all of that. Like, you're going to lose all that. I reached a point like you where I said, I don't care. This is not authentic. Yeah. This is not who I am. And I know God did not put me on this earth to appease all these people who wouldn't like me if they knew me and the real me. So why do I care? And my husband always says, are they paying your bills? No. So why do we care? Like, why does it matter? But I want to transition into your amazing line that you're launching to kind of like, you know.
Yeah, just stop. Like you had an ad in the Super Bowl, right, for your brand.
Which is a big deal.
Well, not really in the Super Bowl. We can't really afford the Super Bowl yet.
It was amazing.
it was near the Super Bowl.
Yes.
On purpose. Because there's no other time of year where people pay as much attention to advertising as sort of the lead up to the Super Bowl. So we made our own ad called Real Girls Rock, which really was meant initially to be a celebration of just female athleticism. But what we wanted to also highlight is for those women who do stand up for the integrity and protection of women's sports, not only are they enduring this gruesome, brutal training, they are also enduring abuse and harassment and threats to their physical safety. And so we sort of tell that story in a minute and a half. And it went insanely viral because J.K. Rowling shared it the second day after it launched. So
she's been a big vocal, advocate of this movement as well, is another woman too.
Yeah. Yeah. Are you feeling like now you're finally getting like that support you didn't have in the past? Like, you feeling like much vindicated in everything that you've done? You feeling like that support has definitely increased as time has gone on? Or you still feel like you're out there kind of on a limb?
Or I'm going to add to that real quick, too. Or like I did. Did you get a slew of people coming in and sliding into your DMs who cannot publicly say that they support you and say,
girl,
we are so behind this, and like I can't say it out loud, and I am in agreement,
which is terrible, it's like,
but I don't know,
get out there.
A lot of that,
yes,
and I have very little patience for that. Like, at first I found it encouraging because I was like, oh, there's supporters out there, and then I got mad, and their excuse is, I'm the breadwinner in my family. Guess who else is? Me. Do you have principles or do you not? So I have and these are people, CEOs who run their own companies. Like, if you can't change the culture and stand up for a culture of, open exchange of ideas and free speech and, that men are men and women, if you can't do that in your own company, then I don't know who can. So I certainly feel more supported. We are the majority, at least as it comes to the issue of, biological reality, but it doesn't feel like it when you're out here saying. So most people are still in the silent majority and too scared.
Yeah.
So I feel like we're very far from having one. And, no one will put me on mainstream media, quote unquote mainstream. I mean, arguably Fox is the most mainstream. It has more viewers than any other news network. Yeah. And they will platform us and our message all day long. But, you know, the New York Times, CNN, they still won't touch it with a 10-foot pole. Now, arguably they're dying. That is true. They're dying. But it is sort of like the, if you're there, it's like the, that's when it's true and respectable, sort of, you know, like they now have the gall to publish articles about how kids were harmed during COVID. So now we're all allowed to say
now
it.
You're like,
until we see it there. Sorry. Yeah. And I'll tell you a very, I won't tell the whole story because I'm about to write something on it. I was invited to a very main, you know, I go and speak at things all the time, and I was invited to this very mainstream business conference a few months ago, and I was shocked because I was like, you guys are not going to want to hear from me. Yeah. I had spoken there before when I was, you know, not the person I am perceived to be now, but they insisted they did, and they knew that it was controversial, but they wanted me to talk about the idea of, you know, free speech in corporate, a culture of open debate and dialogue in corporate America and how that benefits businesses and creativity and innovation. And we need to get back to that. They wanted me to talk about that. I was like, well, I can talk about that all day long. So we had all these meetings to, you know, figure out what the talk would be about. And they just called and canceled because they posted that I would be there and people complained.
Wow.
So I tell you this story. First of all, who cares if people complain?
Exactly.
But I tell you, these are HR leaders from the top 800 companies in the country. They couldn't handle being in a room with me. That was too unsafe.
Unsafe.
So I leave you with that to say, do you think we're done?
No, we're not. And we have a long ways to go.
Yeah.
100%. And I mean, I'm all in for supporting your brand. And if you want to talk about it real quick, let's go. I love it. I love what you're doing.
Awesome. Yeah. So I started this brand XXXY Athletics in March of 2024. So we're close to a year old. You know, a few things prompted it. I mean, frankly, I could get a job and I need to work. You know, no one wanted me, the big mouth brand president lady who wouldn't stop talking about COVID. I'd sort of violated some pact that I didn't know was a pact I'd made by, you know, talking in my own voice and not reading from a script and not listening when people told me I had to shut up. So nobody would hire me, even though by 2023 it was already clear I'd been pretty right. So that was the first thing. And then the second was, I looked around at all these athletic brands and no one was willing to kind of address the elephant in the room. They all pretend to champion and celebrate female athletes, but they won't touch this very important issue of protecting women's sports. Because I believe once one male breaches the barrier of women's sports, they're not women's sports anymore. And eventually there will be no women in women's sports. It'll all be all men. So I had this idea. I put a little team of band of rebels together, many of whom have also been canceled in their own way. And I got some people here in Denver where I live who believed in the idea to invest along with myself, of course. And we were off to the races and people have been so amazingly supportive and I think relieved to have a brand that aligns with their values, that is also a brand of the highest quality.
Awesome.
And I mean, that's, you know, you ran Levi's for so long and you just, I just really love what you're doing and where your story is going. I just think it's incredible. You, for me, if we did have a daughter, I would want her to see what you're doing as a woman. And I kind of feel like as a pioneer, of regardless if you agree or disagree with somebody, I feel like if you can take a stand and stand firm in something you believe in without the fear of what's to come, that says something about you. I mean, that just, again, doesn't matter what it is, you are standing firm in your core beliefs. And I applaud you for that. And we're so grateful to have you on our show. And you're just amazing. I can't wait to see what happens and where
you
ends
go next.
Up.
Yeah. But kudos to you for everything
you're
you
so
did.
Kind
you've done.
Thanks. I mean, now I'm just like, let's just whatever. Like, just, I'll say anything now. I got nothing to lose. I just, you know, you might as well keep going. But, you know, this isn't where I expected to be in my mid-50s, certainly. I, you know, thought I'd be more on the kind of downswing towards retirement. And, you know, I'm fighting every day to get this business going. But I'm truly having the time of my life. Yeah. It's a ton of fun. It's really, really hard. Yeah. You know, this founder work is not for the faint of heart. But lucky for me, I am not faint of heart. But I wanted to give your listeners or viewers a discount opportunity to go check out the brand. If you use the code at checkout, Saints20, you'll get 20% off.
Yes.
So just put that in when you're checking out. We have so much new, amazing stuff. For spring, we have tennis gear and golf gear and just like hardworking workout gear, as well as all the casual stuff, sweats and tees and caps and stuff. So I hope folks will check it out.
Definitely. Awesome. Saints 20. And we will definitely check it out.
Yeah, we definitely support.
Have you back on another time.
You guys are great.
Thank you so much, Jen. And we appreciate you.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Well, I appreciate you. I can't really imagine what you went through in the modeling industry. I haven't been on the other side of it, hiring models. I can only imagine how harrowing it was. So good for you coming out of it.
The eating disorder thing.
On the other side.
If you ever want to come back on, thank you. I mean, and another time away from this, and I am going to do a segment on eating disorders and what that does and what that did for me and maybe someone like you if you know some. But I do want to address that because that still is such a huge issue in our society today. And especially again, we grew up without social media, primarily in our younger years. It wasn't until, you know, but the modeling industry in itself is, you know, it's nothing like gymnastics, but you know, that pressure was there. I mean, you either work or you're doing something else in New York. So, That's another day, we'll get into that now. But I would love to have you, if you want to just focus on that at one point, I'd love to have you on.
Yeah, no, I would love to. That was a struggle for me until my kind of late 20s to just put it behind me. It's really hard. I think you probably experienced this, but I remember in gymnastics where it was sort of beaten into us, I really thought I could do these things. And then when I left the gym, I would leave it behind, but you really, and I'm sure that's true as a model, you know, I'm just doing this for the job, but you incorporate it into your way of thinking about yourself. And it's incredibly destructive and, it's compulsive and you end up, you know, thinking your only value is in that number on the scale.
Yeah, and noticeably, you know, my bones were sticking out of my body. You know, it was just like, it wasn't until I met my future husband where he looked at me, and he was very into fitness, and he said, I love you, but you don't look good. This is not healthy, because I did all the wrong things, and even without the eating disorder, I was doing all the wrong things in the gym. What I was drinking, I was smoking, I was like, anything to keep me into a size 0-2, whatever I had to do, because that's what's making me all the money. But I won't bore you with that right now or get into that. I can talk about that for years.
I understand it. Yeah. Well, I hope you're doing better now.
Oh, obviously, my gosh. I gained 80 pounds with my child. I was like, this is heaven. I'm eating all the burritos. I did not care. And once I had Cyrus, our son, that for some reason it was like God was like, I could get back into it. And I said, no, I'm done. I don't want to live this life anymore. I wanted to be a mom. I started my own company, and I said, I was hiring models again. And I was like, I am so done with this and putting this pressure on myself and this unhealthy lifestyle that I was even hiding from people. I mean, nobody really knew what I was doing. I mean, nobody knew. It was it was disgusting what I was doing. And I don't even like saying it. I don't even want to give anybody the insight of what I was doing, because I don't
idea.
I don't want exactly. Yeah. It's almost like I want to talk about it, but I don't want to have some young girl say, "Oh, is that how she lost weight? Oh, maybe that's how I can lose weight." You know?
Oh, I listened to people talking about those things. There were all these books on anorexia in the 80s that, you know, I'm older than you, but I looked at them. They were supposed to be sort of warnings. But I was like, oh, this is a manual.
Yeah, exactly. It was like a blueprint to getting to your ideal weight of what you thought that should be. And no, I just, you know, oh gosh, the stories. But we're going to have you back on. I would love to have you back on, even one-on-one.
Awesome.
So
sure.
Thank you so much, Jen.
Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. Very nice to meet you.
Yeah, nice to meet you both. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely.
Take care.
Have a good day.